downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
Hey, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. Hey, I'm Dr. Lisa, and I give a shit. I do. I care about you. Whatever's going on in your life, I do. Get in touch with me anytime. I'm here for you, okay? I really had a great time yesterday. That whole Michael Cohen thing just really made me feel good. I think the problem for me is that I wind up disassociating it from reality and just see it as like a book or a story. It's a great story, but it's actually affecting people's lives. Anyway, you got to enjoy life when you can. So anyway, thanks for listening. Let me tell you about our mobile apps, okay? Because I know you want to listen to, like, you have your phone on you all the time, and I know you want to listen to Radio Free Brooklyn all the time. So you go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/iPhone or radiofreebrooklyn.org/Android. And then you can become one of us, one of the crazy people of Radio Free Bushwick that's involved with every kind of music and every kind of culture and everything. I think we even have a show now that's about getting a job, believe it or not, where they're actually trying to get people jobs on the show or something. So anyway, I am now looking at my guest, Ken Johnson. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Dr. Lisa.
He called me Dr. Lisa. So anyway, I am really so cool that we have Ken Johnson on today. Right, Ken Johnson?
if you say so.
I do. Yeah. And this is my show. Look, I'm in control now. Ken, do I seem more in control like right now than before when we were just chatting? Do you feel like I'm taking charge now?
You seem a little manic.
A little manic.
Yeah. Which is probably appropriate.
Well,
under
the
circumstances.
I've got to run this thing.
I don't know how you do it.
I don't know how, Ken. I really don't. Because I have guests like you.
Look at all these wires. And, Jesus.
I know. Doesn't it look like I would know more than I do, like, technically? You think I know what I'm doing technically, right? Just by looking at it. Because there's a board and all this stuff. But you don't really. Anyway, that's a whole nother story. So I want to talk about Ken. Let's see if we can make him self. Are you feeling self-conscious now?
Yes.
Okay. So here's what I'm going to say. Here's what I'm going to say about Ken.
All right.
Okay, so Ken Johnson, great guy, very, very smart, funny, all that stuff. Okay, so we got that out of the way. We like Ken, for sure. And everyone at Radio Free Brooklyn, a lot of people know Ken, love Ken. So the thing, and I just found out that Ken's daughter got married on December 11th, right?
That's true.
Yeah, so shout out to her. And the wedding sounded great, by the way. It sounded really meaningful. I'm here because I want to talk to Ken about his work, Ball and Cone. Now, it's really hard to describe Ball and Cone, not because it's simple and complex at the same time. It's basically, I'm going to say, a cartoon about two characters that you anthropomorphize. One is literally a round circle ball, and the other is a cone. And they go through life. And they have adventures, and until recently, they didn't say anything, and you could really learn some. Like, one of my favorite ones that stuck in my head today is the two of them at, like, a crossroads, and one says life, and one says death. I don't know. I love that one.
Oh, the sign.
Got stuck in my head. And then, anyway, I'm going to let Ken tell you about that. Before we get on to Ken, I got to tell you, like, a little bit about Ken, because he has a very impressive background, so, right, Ken? He went to Brown, so that's a big deal, right? You went to Brown. Brown is, like, such a cool university, right? And then he went to State University at SUNY in Albany, he has a master's degree in studio art with a concentration in painting. He is a very, very well-known and respected journalist in the field of art. He has written it for, like, every important publication there is. He also wrote a book called Are You Experienced? How Psychedelic Consciousness Transformed Modern Art. And that was published in June 2011. Okay, so that's the background of Ken. And now I'm going to have Ken describe Ball and Cone. And by the way, folks, as I like to say, do your own fucking research, okay? So I posted everything that you, you know, can. I posted a picture. I posted a lot of stuff on my Instagram, Dr. Lisa Levy, SP, and my Facebook page. So you can, there's all the links there and stuff like that. So you should go and look it up. But I'm going to, so Ken, go ahead. Tell us about, describe Ball and Cone in the way that you can in broad strokes, because it's complex.
Oh, well, yeah, like you said, they're two geometric figures. They each have two legs and each has one eye. So they're, but they go around, they're friends. They're non-gendered, so there's no erotic relationship. Although friendship is, of course, erotic. But so they travel around, so there's not much interaction between them. It's more like they encounter situations that usually have some sort of paradoxical effect, like a section, like a rectangle turns out to be a door.
Mm-hmm.
Where you thought at first it was like a plank, and then they go through the door. Or,
well, they're kind well, they're kind of like stand-ins. They're anthropomorphized non-entities, almost sort of.
Non-entities.
Non-entities, meaning like they're not, they're human. But they're not male or female or any, they're sort of like, they're like the ultimate everyman kind of.
I sometimes think that they have the sensibility of cats.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That they're curious about things and they walk mm-hmm. around and are assessing how to interact with a given situation, which includes the way that drawings are framed.
So there
includes some ambiguity between two and three dimensions.
So they're also conscious of that they're cartoons. They're self-aware.
Well, that comes later
mm-hmm.
when they start talking about. We haven't talked about.
So let's
the book.
Here's the deal. So Ken, how long have you been doing these cartoons? Like.
I think it's been 5 years, four
5 years.
5 years,
and you've probably done
thousands. Yeah.
Actually, I had a question for you right away. On your Instagram, you only have 250. Do you edit them, or did you?
Oh.
How is that?
Oh, yeah, that's an edited.
Why did you edit it?
Well, Instagram's a little less flexible than Tumblr. Like, you can't do sequences, and it has to appear, you know. I don't really know how to work Instagram that well.
Well, here's what it seemed like. It seemed like that you were like, okay, I'm going to get rid of all the, because I was looking at the dates, too. So it just looked like, oh, I'm going to get rid of, I'm only going to have like a year's worth or 2 years' worth.
Oh, I can't honestly.
You can't
I can't.
Answer
I can't
that.
Even remember.
I stumped him already.
All I know is that most people I say they don't do. Most people I know don't do Tumblr, and they say you should do Instagram. So finally, I capitulated, and so late in the game, I got on Instagram.
So anyway, which brings us to let me just tell you how to look them up while we're talking. Okay, so go to Instagram and it's at ball_and spelled out. _cone_ and the Tumblr is ball and cone all written out like that, all three words .tumblr.com. So yeah, I mean that was another thing actually, Ken. I don't want to digress from your work, but I was thinking about that. I was thinking about like the promotion of it. I guess is how I'm thinking about it, probably because I'm projecting onto that. Because lately it seems like getting your work, do you think about getting your work out there, or is that something like you're really into making it? You have books and you have your file.
Well, I always figured I'd do books mm-hmm. out of it.
Mm-hmm.
and vaguely that there might be a gallery show.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it became a relationship to the audience, or what I thought was the audience, because I'd put one up every day, and there would be responses. And on Tumblr, most of the people that seem to follow me, I have no idea who they are, but they're often kids from other countries.
Wow, really?
I mean, it's a weird, a lot of people are interested, who are into comics, you know, comic nerd types.
So do you have like relationships with them in the sense of like, it's the same people commenting, or do you have a sense of who they are? Any of them, or how many followers?
Not really, but they seem to be mostly kids.
Is that?
Like between 25 and 15.
That's so funny.
And so on Instagram, it's different. It's the people who follow me are mostly from the art world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a much smaller number.
Oh, is it? How many followers? Because you have a pretty good amount on Instagram. It's like 1,700. How many on Tumblr?
Like 8,200.
So that's so funny. So that's an audience that you're reaching that you probably didn't even expect to reach?
Right.
So that was another thing that I noticed, because your work is so good and so consistent. And one of the things about Ken's work, people, is that Ken is starting with a very pure and simple idea, an anthropomorphized cone and an anthropomorphized sphere. But the situations, the level of emotion and thinking and dilemmas and just everything that these two beings, they're like beings, they feel like beings, these two small beings are involved in, is endless. I mean, that's kind of the genius, brilliance of what,
genius, that's
genius,
good. Yeah, I like
genius
that.
Of what you do, Ken. I mean, that, I think that's what people, I imagine that's a real common thread that really people respond to, is just, like, one on its own is brilliant, you know, but then as a series or as a body of work, it's like insane how much you can possibly get out of them as personalities and thinking beings, right?
Yeah. Okay. And I can't really explain it, but so my process involves, like, I do a lot of visualizing. Usually I like to have it fairly complete in my mind before I actually start drawing something.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'll sometimes just start by doodling and then it'll come about.
Mm-hmm.
But
so you go right to the finished drawing, you mean? Or to a finished pencil and then a drawing?
Yeah, pencil and then
a drawing. Uh-huh.
And then onto the scanner and into Tumblr.
Uh-huh. So Tumblr's your medium, really, isn't it?
I guess so.
Yeah, it sounds like it's what you find the best way to work with what you're working with.
Yeah, and I feel like it shouldn't matter, but it matters to me if some things get liked and others don't.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about too, because
I think it's like a comedian. You don't know if it's working unless people are laughing.
Yeah.
And if I get, like, I put something up that I think is actually really interesting and it gets like 14 comments or likes, I think, well, they just don't, I don't know. But it's disappointing. It makes me sad.
Well, you know, that's the whole thing.
But
about
I take
art.
That as information, you know.
Right. So I'm wondering, has it influenced the way that you, work? Like, I'm going to say this clearly, like, I think there's a really direct connection between you as a human and your personality and who you are through and through and this work. I think in a way you boil down, I was saying this earlier to you, Ken, that you kind of boil down the essence of, like, a lot of your ideas into something that people can digest.
Well, when I do one,
that's entertaining.
If I'm I'm always thinking like, what's funny? Mm-hmm. I want to make something that's funny to me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I get a funny idea, which is usually involves some kind of paradox,
mm-hmm.
some kind of visual and some, just at some level, conceptual paradox, makes me laugh a little bit. It makes mm-hmm. my mirth meter go like that, you know? And then I feel like, I can work with this. So the funny thing is, some people say this, and is that I'm not intending any other emotional effects,
mm-hmm.
but it seems to happen anyway.
Hmm.
Something a little more than just,
so you,
just humor. There's some sense of them that they have this, there's a pathos about it, that they're caught in this world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like we all are,
mm-hmm.
you know? So, I mean, I feel like, yeah, that their sense of what they are in the world is like mine.
Like that
it's, everything is puzzling to me.
Right. How everything evolved this certain way.
Yeah.
Like, because nothing does really make sense if you think about it that hard. If you think about it really hard, a lot of things, I mean, the way society is structured for one, or why we decided that, you know, why we wear clothes that are so specific and just like different.
Well,
weird things.
So with Ball and Cone, you sort of like try to filter out that level of detail.
Right.
And so I don't know if there's like a universally comprehensible kind of cartoon that anybody from any culture would get. It's interesting that at Desert Island Comics,
mm-hmm.
that Gabe there has been selling.
That's a really good store on Metropolitan, right? In Williamsburg.
Right. And the first volume of Ball and Cone, which I did almost 6 years ago. Well, mm-hmm. whatever, near the beginning. He's been selling fairly regularly.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And he said little kids like it.
Because it doesn't have words, but it has it's connect, but what's so
and
weird.
And I thought that made me like happier than anything.
See, that's so weird because the thing that's so weird about it, that is so weird because they're really complex and simple ideas. That's what's so weird about the cartoons is that, do you know what I mean? Does that make any sense?
Well, part of it is they're cute. The whole issue of them being cute is amusing to me.
And also,
you know, so cute is like a cute thing is a thing you want to take care of and sort of cherish or, you know, protect.
Mm-hmm.
So they immediately elicit, I suppose, psychologically from the reader, that level, that kind of care.
So funny.
See, part of it is, I think, or this has been proven by neuroscientists, that
mm-hmm.
the same structures in your brain that produce your view or what you see when you look at reality is the same as when you're only purely imagining something.
Wait, say that again. I want to think about that. Say it again. Sorry.
If you imagine a situation like you're at the beach, say, mm-hmm. on a nice day,
mm-hmm.
in your imagination, a part of you takes that as actually being at the beach.
In your imagination, yeah.
Yeah, but there are certain feelings that will be triggered by that as if you were actually there.
So when you are at the beach.
Yeah.
So you're saying,
or like, say like this, imagine some time when you were embarrassed.
Okay.
So I made this actually a comic recently. Imagine a time when you were embarrassed, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you feel now?
Thinking about it, embarrassed.
Yeah. Right.
Right, right.
But it's only in your imagination. Why would you be embarrassed?
Right. Well, that's another story, but yes.
It has nothing to do with what you're embarrassed by. It's that what you imagine has a degree of reality in your consciousness. So that you react as if it were real.
Right. And so in other words, like your consciousness in a certain way is almost more powerful than your actual life, than being in the moment, than your physical surroundings.
Well, like 5% comes from outside through your five senses. Mm-hmm. That's a tiny bit of what goes to produce consciousness. I didn't know that. The rest is top down. It's the brain, like, taking these strands of just pure signals.
Oh, really?
That travel through your, like, from your ears and your eyes and your nose. They go into your brain, and then they're mixed and synchronized. And then that produces, somehow, nobody knows how, a subjective image of the world.
Wow. So,
but in order to construct that image, the brain has to have already in place a lot of knowledge about the world.
So how does
if you see a house, say, mm-hmm. your brain says, oh, I've seen houses before. So the brain is organizing all this information into a house shape.
So if you grew up on like a different planet or something, your brain would adapt to that is that what you mean?
Oh, that's then I mean, if you come from a different culture where all your experiences are not like here, then what you'll experience is a lot of confusion.
You mean if you're in a different place?
Yeah. If you're in a foreign
country, yeah.
And so the templates that were functional for your homeland are not working for this new place.
Right. And are those formed when you're fairly young?
They start. Yeah.
What do you think about pre-verbal? I mean, a lot of stuff I believe, or what I've read, is like done, like gets, but before you learn how to talk, I think a lot of things get really, that's when you really take in a lot.
I have a granddaughter who's 16 months
old. Oh my God.
So I've given this
a lot. Open the door. It's hot in here. I think we'll be okay. Thanks.
So I've given this a lot of thought.
Wow, you get to see a little kid, a baby? Wow.
Yeah, it's remarkable.
So what?
Well, this is not original with me, but Adam Gopnik has a sister whose last name is Gopnik. Now I forget her name. But but she writes, she's like a psychologist and very, very widely known. But she wrote a book called The Philosophical Baby. Mm-hmm. And she talks about how babies are like little scientists. They're trying to figure out what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, fairly soon they get used to what's regular. They may fight it, but regularity eventually overcomes their fantasies, the reality principle.
And they like routine. It's kind of like I noticed
already like this child has a sense of humor.
Right.
And part of that has to do with, I'm just rambling here now, but it has to do with, like, consciousness has a lot to do with starting to understand or to deal with counterfactuals. Like, statements or representations that are actually not true of what's going on. Her name is B. Mm-hmm. So she's looking at me with this sly look, and she's biting on a banana that's actually a knitted yarn banana. Like, and I go, oh, you can't, you know. She's playing with, she was like a year old. She's playing with the idea of it's a banana, it's not a banana, or what's appropriate to do with a banana, what's appropriate to do with a fake banana. That's so sophisticated, really.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where almost every comedy comes out of that.
So it's almost like, I mean, our children, we tend to think culturally that children aren't smart or educated or something, but they probably have a lot of the same innate intelligence, right?
So why are they, what inspires them to keep looking, trying to figure out things?
Mm-hmm.
A part of it is like this problem solving they need to solve, humans have to solve.
Because they have to figure it out.
They have to figure things out. They have to solve problems. And so what makes people want to solve problems? It's because when you do solve a problem, it's deeply satisfying. Like, and the dopamine system floods you with pleasure. And you have this eureka feeling. And I think her name is Allison Gopnik. But mm-hmm. she says, for explanation is like an orgasm. It's like, so it puts everything into place. And not that all explanations are true. Mm-hmm. It's just that if the explanation satisfies you, it's like, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
So humor is a little like that. Like, if you get a joke, partly it's a cognitive, you know, I get it. But the mirth part is different.
Because, so how do you say, explain. Yeah. What do you?
So mirth is, well, this is what my latest project is
yes,
about.
Yes.
Which is a comic book about humor.
Well, I'll just,
that's
give
why
this,
I keep talking
I'll just
about
give you guys some background. So anyway, you know, I'm a huge fan of Ken's work. I've been following it for a long time. And I noticed that in his latest book, which just came out recently, he actually started using words that for the first time, the ball and cone had actual word balloons and started talking. And their personalities are very similar to what you would imagine from knowing the characters. But it is really interesting. So now you're working on a book.
Incidentally, one of my followers, I forget whether it was Tumblr or Instagram, said, posted a comment, "Don't let them talk!" Exclamation
Oh,
point.
That's so funny.
And I felt very ambivalent about that.
So what? Yeah. So tell us how you got to, because you've done so much. So how? What do you? What's the talking about? And what's the next project?
Well, in this book, the one that you can get from Amazon. Yeah, they started talking like I felt like I'd run through every conceit, everything. My imagination for silent comics was just running on fumes.
Do you think also maybe you got a little more comfortable with them and you started getting to know them better and you know what they're going to, you kind of could picture them talking more? These are extensions of you. Do you feel like?
Well, yeah, I was leaving out a lot, like you said, a lot of what I think about. And I was trying to write a book about humor in contemporary art, which wasn't quite crystallizing. And then I thought, I'll do a comic book about humor. I've got the characters, they can just talk about it, like Socratic dialogues. And they can, and they, what they're doing doesn't have to do with anything that they're talking about. So it runs along, not exactly parallel, but there are two levels.
Right.
They're just doing things, they're walking around. Recently they're throwing a ball back and forth while, at the same time while they're having this very abstract conversation about what exactly humor is, why do we have a sense of humor, why is a sense of humor a good thing.
So it's interesting, it's kind of like the book that you're talking about doing, it's like, it seems like your relationship with these characters is really a good vehicle for you to talk through, express yourself, right? And then it's kind of going to be more satisfying for you to take whatever it was that you wanted to do in your humor book, and put it and just do it that way, because it's kind of like they've become kind of like you're a little bit like your mouthpiece in a way, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Which is hilarious.
No, it's
right?
a way to talk to myself. So I think, you know, what's interesting is that there's a conversation. It keeps going back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't sure. That's a hard thing to do when you're writing explanatory prose in a, you know, a scholarly volume.
Right,
you have to So
you can probably get a lot more ideas in there. I'm going to remind people that they're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. Don't you think it's a great idea? Which is the greatest radio station on the planet.
Absolutely.
And so anyway, you should go to radiofreebrooklyn.org. You know, we're a 501c and we have this great program. We're teaching teens how to make their own radio shows and then broadcasting them for free. We're just doing that because we are trying to do something for for our people, for people. So go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/donate and donate some money. Also, while we're at it, I'm going to remind you where to see Ken's work, Ball and Cone. So you can go to Instagram, ball_and_cone_. And then you can go to Tumblr, where he posts, which is a much more in-depth look at his work. And we are hearing it's actually probably the best way to see Ken's work. And that's at ballandcone, all written out, .tumblr.com. Okay, we did that, Ken.
Oh, you can get books at Desert Island Comics.
Yeah, and who's your publisher? We wanted to, you were saying he's great.
Well, this is, I had in mind wanting to do another Ball and Cone book, but wasn't really sure. I mean, the first one was self-published, and I thought I'd self-publish another one. And I got to know Ryan Forster through some other connections, and he's an interesting young artist, and he's the publisher of Rat Star Press, which somebody pointed out to me recently is a palindrome.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. Anyway, and he suggested doing it as in the form of a book that measures 6 by 4 inches, but that would be fat.
Oh, that's so funny.
So this book is 6 by 4 inches, and it's like an inch thick. It's 321 pages of metaphysical adventure. So
I like that, metaphysical adventure. See, that's yeah. I like that.
So Ryan had a lot to do with how this came about.
It's really.
It was going to be cheap too. $10.
Yeah.
From Amazon. So it was very interesting to me to get away from this sort of, the prestige art world.
Yeah.
And not really think about, what the competition for attention within that world.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting because, I mean, folks, Ken was an extremely well-known critic and art critic, and this is completely different from what you were doing before.
Yeah.
And is it a completely or how do you feel? Or like, is it a different audience?
Well, some of them, there are some comics in which Ball and Cone like go to the museum and look at different things.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea, in a way, it's like they're innocent eyes just going into the museum and then these, a Duchamp sculpture or a Mondrian painting. It's sort of like, what does that look like to beings like this,
There's one where you had an art opening that I thought was really funny because it captured, like, they look more like art than the actual art on the walls, the characters. But it gives you that feeling of how super, just like it doesn't really matter what the people there are there to show off. It's kind of like, it kind of felt like that more, like they seem to have more attention than the art. There was more.
I never made that comment. You're thinking of somebody else.
No, I'm not. I interpreted it my way.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. What was I going to say?
Oh, yeah. So I was talking to Ryan and he said, people say I need a logo. And I said, oh, that's a great idea for Rat Star Press. And I said, let's make one. And he said, well, make a rat eating its own tail. So if you look on the publisher's page.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
That was my.
Oh, that's so funny because I saw that image in here somewhere. And
no, it's on like the first page.
Okay. Well, anyway, they can't see it.
They have to get the book to see
it. They have to get the book. Get the book so you can see it. But that's really funny. So there was something I noticed that like there's no. They seem to be asexual except in one frame where there were breasts. Do you know which picture I was talking about?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So
that was a Southwest landscape.
Oh, I see. So this was my theory, and you tell me what the reality is. So my theory was that that sex is so complex and it would, and emotions, and that maybe you didn't want to bring in like direct emotions and sex into what you're already doing, or what's your, what, so what, that was what I was thinking, but what's the reality? What is it? What's the truth?
I really don't know. The one that you refer to, they're walking in a landscape, and the mountains are in the form of breasts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, they're not breasts.
It's a joke. In a way, it's a joke about the land or mountains being tits. You know, it's, can I say that?
Tits?
Yeah.
Fuck yeah. Fuck okay. You can say tits.
But I don't know, sexual humor is not very interesting to me.
So you mean your focus is like
maybe because I'm so old that I don't have the same interest that I might have had.
Well, I think sexual humor, especially when you're talking about doing something visual, is so, you know, overdone or well worn. It's hard to make like something surprising. But what I'm hearing from you is that humor is really important to you in doing this work, right?
Humor.
Yeah. So I could see how sex wouldn't necessarily lend itself to humor unless you were drawing like penises or something like that, or like where, unless it was very overtly sexual.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it wouldn't be, it would really be hard to
communicate.
Well,
part of it is I just don't like sexual images in this, when I'm thinking about Ball and Cone, just don't come to mind really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they're probably really different parts of who you are.
So maybe maybe I'm thinking at a pre-sexual level as opposed to post-sexual.
Maybe. I also wonder, so you're a father, right?
Yes.
So do you think that maybe, is there some part of you that draws on that?
The Ball and Cone came about because when I was in graduate school in 1976, I made a painting of a little house with a cone and in the doorway, the open door, and indoors is a ball.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of surrealistic Magritte-like thing. But the cone and the ball had no feet, no appendages. They were just geometric objects.
Mm-hmm.
So, did I ever tell you this story? So,
I don't know,
anyway, it was.
They haven't heard it.
I gave it to friends for a wedding present.
Uh-huh.
And it turned out that this was a guy I went to high school with. And so his son is Ryan Trecarton.
Ah.
So Ryan grew up with this painting in his house.
Mm-hmm.
And Ryan, for those who don't know, is
he's a
famous
major
video artist.
Right.
So, anyway, Ryan appropriated the painting and went on his travels, and then the painting was lost.
Like, what do you mean appropriated? He took it with him?
Yeah.
So he actually physically took it with him, like to college or?
Well, no, this was after college.
As an art project.
As part of his, he had this entourage of people.
Yeah.
They traveled
so
around in a bus.
Videos.
He included it in an installation they did in LA, and because he told me that it had a profound influence on him.
Really?
Growing up with this painting.
That's so funny. So it is really interesting, isn't it? How, I mean, I haven't heard you talk about that before. Like, I haven't thought about that, how this is really appealing to children.
Huh. I guess that's, yeah.
And I wonder what
I mean,
that
I
is.
Haven't, you know, maybe that, and when I think about art that I like, most of what I like would probably appeal to children.
Really? Like
Jeff Koons.
Jeff
I don't
Koons,
know. You
like,
know, I
yeah.
mean, you know, I know there's a lot wrong with Jeff Koons, but
yeah, I like his,
I think
his
a genius
stuff.
So,
yeah.
Anyway,
no, but
you know, pop art, I like the whole, you know.
Yeah, pop art, it's very like intellectual. It's intellectual. It's like something that like you can think about. It's very like, but it's like really funny that it appeals to children because is there something so universal about it? That's what's so interesting. And also what I thought was what I thought was really weird is, like, I thought, honestly, I thought that when I looked at your Instagram account, I thought, oh, you know, you must have, like, you know, 10,000. I was surprised that you have less Instagram followers than I would have thought, being somebody that people in the art world know and respect. And then you look at, like, you know, people who are, you know, much less well-known or less interesting in the art world who have, like, so many more followers. So I was wondering, like, about that, like, if you were or weren't promoting it, or if, do you think, like, I mean, I'm just impressed by that your audience of children has really, really gets it and really loves it or is really drawn to it. And that really interests me. And what do you think the difference, you know, I'm trying to, like, think, like.
Oh, well, I don't know how you, how, I mean, I signed up for Instagram. Instantly, I had, like, 1,100 followers.
Right.
Because they
know, who you are or whatever. Yeah. Or they, people follow you.
Because the algorithms present to everybody who goes on, oh, you should know this person and that person.
Right.
But after that, it was really slow.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how. On Tumblr, you can get, there are mechanisms for, what do you call it? For increasing your, people follow you, and they follow, people follow your followers, and your followers follow their followers, and there's a, this chain of, of following, that Tumblr allows that Instagram actually doesn't.
Mm-hmm. So I guess what I was thinking about is, I wonder, like, there's so many people that I deal with on the station, and, you know, so many people, myself included, I guess, of course, that are so interested in promoting their work. And you seem...
Oh, do I care about promoting my work? I don't. Well,
you seem like you really like making the work.
Yeah.
And I think also it sounds like you found a really great audience on Tumblr, and that sounds really satisfying. And it's kind of nice what you said before about that you're not feeling that competitiveness, that it's hard not to feel competitiveness in the art world, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Is that right?
Well, see, for most of my time in the art world, I was a critic. So maybe there was a little feeling of competition with other critics, but...
Well, there's always that. Yeah. But, you know, Instagram and the internet has changed so much of that anyway. About what is, you know, like, I think what's really interesting, like, in your case, is that you seem to really have a dialogue with two audiences.
Oh, well, see, I know lots of artists who really have been extremely supportive, and, you know, I've gotten plenty of encouragement.
Well, also,
it started with, I sent the first couple of Ball and Comb. Oh, what I was going to say was Ball and Comb, the original Ball and Comb painting was stolen and lost. So I thought I should make a new one and give them, you know, to replace it. So I started making ball and cone drawings, but it became ball and cone, like, right away.
So
that's how it came about.
And that was...
But why ball and cone? I thought, in the original painting, the cone is standing outside, the ball is inside. I had, like, 6 months before that, I had gotten married.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was young. I was, like, 23. My wife was 22.
Wow, you're so young.
And so... you know, there was in the back of my, there's a lot of my mind thinking, what have I got myself into, you know? So I thought, like, the cone is like me standing at the threshold, still not feeling like he's all in yet.
Oh, really?
You know what I mean? Like, it was like an ambivalence and anxiety about having gotten married.
That's so interesting.
So it began as they're not just anthropomorphic, they embody a certain feeling that I had then, but then, you know, 40 years later, it's a very different.
Do you think it's like a coded way of communicating? Like, did you make a ball and cone partly because you didn't want your wife to know? I mean, seriously, you wanted to express that feeling, but
well, at the time,
you don't
want
to put it out there publicly.
It was only years later that I interpreted it that way.
Ah.
At the time, to me, it was just a little bit of surrealist fun.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting.
I was making a lot of other pictures involving spheres and other geometric objects.
But it seems as if there is like it's almost like you've made these characters that you have a way of talking to and then talking to them and like getting them to know what you want to express and then having them do that in a certain way.
Well, sometimes it goes the other way. Like they express something and then sometime later I'll think, oh, I see what I was thinking about, but I didn't know at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how has it affected like your life living with these? You live with them, right? You make one every day.
I feel responsible to them.
Do you? Do you? So yeah.
Sometimes I think I can't imagine making another ball and cone thing, but I feel like I can't abandon them.
Really?
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
But have they changed you? Like, have they affected you over the 5 years you've been doing it?
Well, part of it, after I quit writing for the Times, I wanted to write. I still wanted to write something, but I didn't want to write in that way. And then when this idea of this kind of dialogue came to me in the Ball and Cone thing, I started thinking about writing in that form, writing in the form of dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And like I did that for the show at Mimi Park's at Thomas mm-hmm. Park
yeah,
Gallery.
Yeah.
I wrote little dialogues for each of the pieces in the show. This is a show I curated called Zentrified. But it seemed like a really, you know, a lot of philosophical writing is so convoluted and if you distill it down to its basic mm-hmm. soundbite of whatever of these paragraphs, mm-hmm. you can do that.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the humor comes in, because if you take it for what it is, the philosophical writing, it's very dense and, you know, but if you think it like what you're doing is sort of thinking it through to where it's almost funny, right?
Yeah, and I thought, mm-hmm. I'm going to write these dialogues without feeling obliged to be fair to any other philosopher or thinker or writer. I'm just going to write what I think and put it in.
And it also you don't really necessarily, what's so funny is what I was saying about it being so simple and so complex, because you can take it on a lot of levels, but you can take it on a very, what you would imagine a child would, in a very just instinctual way and get it. But you can also think about it a lot harder and think about the implications of it for humanity. Right?
Yeah, and in a way, this comic that I'm working on, I hope will kind of end on a kind of cosmic note.
Mm.
That there's a big picture. I don't really know. I just have this intuitive feeling that I'd like it to.
Get
to the end of the rainbow or something.
Talking to you about your work now, what's seeming really unique to me is that you're using the language of comics, but in a way that I think is, I don't know that much about comics, but I think it's, you know, very original. Like, I don't know of any comic like this myself. Do you?
No.
And so what you're kind of doing is explaining the world in a certain way, or... just it's like you're using the language of comics to communicate very complex ideas that you have in a way that people, I think you have some interest in entertaining.
Well, oh yeah,
right.
That would be nice. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. You have a real interest in entertaining, I think.
If it's not entertaining, then. You know, who's going to look at it?
And humor and being funny. But you yourself, although I do find you humorous and entertaining, I'm talking about the world of performers. Like, you wouldn't be the first, like,
You don't think I'm a funny guy?
I do think you're a funny guy. Absolutely, I think you're a funny guy. But I haven't seen you, like, have you ever thought about doing something that was more performative?
No.
Yeah, I just don't see you in that. I feel like this is really entertaining, and you have a real desire to entertain, but you don't want to be an entertainer yourself.
As a performer. No, that's the beauty of being an artist or a writer, is you're not out in front of people.
But I'm not sure if everybody is that interested in entertaining through their work. Do you? Like the thing
as
about,
opposed to what?
Well, like the thing about painting, you know, painting abstract, whatever the fuck they want to paint, or I think a lot of art is very serious.
Oh, I see. Yeah. But yeah, it has some, something, entertainment is not considered a very high value.
No, and it's also very, one of the things that bothers me personally about a lot of art is it's how opaque it is. It doesn't communicate. Right.
Well, it depends on a particularly informed kind of viewer. So, you know, some of it is arcane, but well known within certain narrow circles.
And that's as a critic. No, but if you don't, if you don't know anything, I'm talking about the general public. Like, I mean, one of my things is like art should be for the general public. So, or that's what I'm talking, that's the direction I'm talking about now.
I mean, there's been lots of artists who are operating at the level of like Finnegan's Wake, you know, making something, you know, that is made for unpacking in a very complicated, layered,
right,
important.
And there's also
way.
Something elitist about that, right, in a certain way.
Well,
I mean, well, like what?
I don't know. You know, if you listen to, I listen to sports talk radio when I'm in the car, and if you listen to the guys, what do you call them? The announcer and the call in people, the host. They go into detail about issues of, say, trades in baseball and or basketball or football. It's like rocket science. I mean, it's
oh,
like,
it can be, I guess. Yeah, I didn't know that.
I mean, somebody walking into that cold would have no idea. It's like if I hear people talking about cricket, I have no idea what they're talking about. But in the American sports, I sort of get it.
That's so funny because, you know, sports.
But I think the art world talks to itself in that way.
Right.
You know, the people who care most about it, they've already like internalized the basics of what it takes to be an art and informed and then, you know, they don't want to have to go over that over and over again.
Right. So they want to assume.
They want to go to the most, you know.
But then there's people just want to enjoy the game.
Yeah. And there's a lot of flash at the, you know, at the Armory Fair, which is coming up soon. And it can be entertaining, but then it's exhausting.
So we have 5 minutes left. So what is your I know we talked about a lot of things. I do think that what's really interesting, though, is that your book is kind of like it's. I just really want you guys to see this book because I have so many artists on the show, and I often say I don't really want to talk about the work so much because people can't see the work. And you can't see it, but there is like, but you really need to process it. You need to process this work. So I think you should go. I have all the links on my Facebook page and on Instagram. So I think that's part of it. But I think what's really interesting is how you have gone through the art world and you have like all that information, all that art history, all that philosophy, all that stuff. And what you've done is found a outlet or a medium for it. And the medium is like a cartoon, which is like considered kind of the opposite of what art is, which is a very complex.
Well, my first ambition when I was in college was to be a New Yorker cartoonist.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I subscribed to the New Yorker, and I never read any of it. All I did was look at the cartoons.
Oh, well.
I didn't even know there was anything interesting to read.
So you have those roots.
And I made cartoons. And then
Have you?
Some printmaking teacher said, you know, I put up my cartoons. He said, well, these are charming, but they're not, you know, you've got to learn other things. You know, so you can't just do that.
So did that, like, would you have gone into cartoons if you hadn't heard that?
No, I was pretty interested in art.
In art.
Generally. Mm-hmm. You know, I by then I wasn't, you know, that wasn't a career track. It was just something I was
playing
that I did.
With. Yeah. So you've come back. I guess.
So I've come back to that for many, many years later. And so I think a better teacher would have said, these look like, because they were little narrative cartoons with characters going on a journey, mm-hmm. something like that. And it was, they were funny. They were cute. Mm-hmm. And he could have said, these look like they have something to do with you. You know?
Well, that's what a good art teacher would do, right?
Yeah. He just said, well, they're cartoons, you know, who gives a shit? So this is an art. So he wasn't that dismissive, but he was dismissive.
No,
I wasn't, you know.
Well, and you.
There's, you know, all kinds of harm is done to young impressionable people in when they go to college.
An art school.
An art school. But I mean, you know, that's a whole other topic.
Well,
but
also, I imagine, like, you paint well. And I think that that might have gotten a bigger response.
Well, I wasn't, I didn't have any art background at that point.
Oh.
I was just, yeah.
Well, you're drawing. I mean, you can draw and paint well, so.
Not then.
Oh, well. So,
but I could make funny cartoons.
Tunes.
I always feel like if I get to a thing and it feels funny to me, then all the other pieces, even if I don't understand what's going on, I know that they're coherent.
So what kind of feedback do you get? Like, what do people say about your, you know, the people? Like, you have a really strong following. I mean, I said you had 1,700 followers, but they're very, very engaged. You have hundreds, you know, you get a strong response. What kind of takeaways have you gotten from having your work on out there?
Oh, just, I can't say all I can say is, I guess the most meaningful were the people who said to me, I've never seen anything like that.
Right.
And so I just kept, so that was a funny thing to, like, in my life, the career I fell into happened only because I wrote some reviews and people said, I really like the way you write, mm-hmm. and we'll pay you for it,
mm-hmm.
about art.
Right.
And it wasn't intentional.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something I seem to be able to do, but nobody was knocking down my door to look at my paintings, fine art.
Well,
so.
But it also seems.
I say one more thing about,
please.
We were talking about the sex or the mm-hmm. non-gendered relationship between ball and cone. I think secretly, I think the ball is feminine and the cone is masculine.
That makes a lot of sense.
And I think the ball is smarter and the cone is kind of like a follower.
Interesting.
The cone is kind of a doofus. So that's part of their relationship. But it's not a sexual relationship. They're friends and companions. Mm-hmm. And that transcends, like if they had a sexual romantic relationship, this is my feeling about the world in general, you know, about people, that we undervalue friends now.
I agree. You know? I agree. Yeah.
And especially in New York where things are so competitive. But, you know, it's
that's so interesting.
And romantic love and sex is a whole different thing. And often leads to despair and unhappiness.